Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
And welcome to the Savage Nation. This is the place, the destination, the state of mind where individual freedom and personal responsibility still reign supreme as they did way back when America was founded 232 years ago. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for the founding father of the Savage Nation, Michael Savage. You know me as the editor of WorldNet Daily. I'm also a friend of the Savage Nation. I'm privileged to be filling in for Michael, who's recuperating from a nasty bout with pneumonia. I know your thoughts and prayers for a complete and speedy recovery go out to Michael, as do mine. By the way, let me say that even though Michael is not operating at 100% yet, his work does not stop. Even when he is hampered by illness, he and his crack team remain actively involved in updating MichaelSavage.com virtually around the clock. So 24/7, wherever you are, you can commune with the Savage Nation by going to MichaelSavage.com. And right now you can be a part of the Savage Nation here by picking up the phone and joining the conversation at 1-800-449-8255. I'll tell you where I want to start today. There's not a doubt in my mind what I want to talk about. I want to talk about something very specific, a forgotten topic in today's media. You know, sometimes when you have an opportunity to participate in a national dialogue of the magnitude of the Savage Nation, it's tough to know where to begin. There are so many important issues to discuss. I mean, you've got the rantings of Ted Turner, which we'll hear later, and you've got Al Gore, and you've got the 2008 election. There are so many important issues to discuss. But I came across something in the foreign news that apparently no one else has noticed. It's big news, or at least it should be. It's a big deal. And I want to bring it to your attention and get your reaction to it. So are you ready? Did you know that the U.S. government is finally getting serious about building a border fence? Yes, this is the good news I have to report to you today. Washington is finally getting serious about building a border fence. And no, I'm not talking about Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff's announcement that one small piece of the fence is finally going to be completed by year's end. That's way too little, way too late. No, I'm talking about millions of dollars more being allocated for engineering teams that will focus on smuggling tunnels and building a sturdier, impregnable border fence. The resources of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have been directed to help with this project. That's the good news. Now, are you ready for the bad news? The bad news is that this border fence is not between the U.S. and Mexico. The fence, supported by new allocations of your U.S. taxpayer dollars and the expertise of the Army Corps of Engineers, is the separating the homicidal maniacs in the Gaza Strip from their Arab neighbors in Egypt. That's right. It turns out that fences can actually be good investments for American taxpayers as long as they are not along the Mexican border. Now, why am I surprised about this? Haven't officials in Washington been telling the American people for at least the last 2 years that building border fences is a waste of time and money? Don't they claim that fences really can't keep undesirables out? Don't they tell us fences are inhumane and oppressive and mean and nasty? Didn't they say you can't build a fence high enough to keep out bad guys? So why is it, I wonder, that a border fence separating Arabs in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula from Arabs in the Gaza Strip is a good thing? Didn't Washington also tell Israelis they shouldn't build a fence to protect their civilian population from Arab terrorists on the West Bank? Why, I must ask, was it morally wrong for the Israelis to build a fence to protect their citizens from Arab terrorists, but it's the right thing for Egypt to do? In fact, it's so right for Egypt, American taxpayers have been volunteered to pick up the tab. Now, in case you haven't been following the news about Egypt's border problems, let me explain them to you. Way back in 1973, Israel captured the Gaza Strip from Egypt during a war Cairo started. That was the Yom Kippur War. Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack on the High Holy Days, hoping to catch Israel off guard and drive the Jews into the sea. Well, Egypt lost that war, as you know. But a few years later, Israel gave back most of the territory it conquered in that defensive war with Egypt, getting Bupkis in return. There was one piece of real estate Egypt didn't want back, and that was the Gaza Strip, which was teeming with terrorists who would just as soon overthrow the Egyptian government as murder innocent Jews in Israel. So Israel kept Gaza. And from 1973 through August 2005, Egypt never had any border security problems because Israel occupied the Gaza Strip. Now, immediately after Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip, not only did the terrorists there, under the leadership of Hamas, begin launching rocket attacks on Israeli civilians, they also began infiltrating Egypt. So, for the 32 years Egypt and Israel shared this small border, Egypt had no border security concerns. As soon as the Arabs of Gaza were given their autonomy over the Gaza Strip, Egypt's border nightmare began. The Gaza Strip is now controlled, as you know, by the murderous band of terrorists known as Hamas. Regularly, these terrorists attempt to breach the Egyptian border for the purpose of smuggling weapons into their little armed caliphate. So Egypt has been forced to build fences and walls to keep the infiltration to a minimum. It's funny. Now, you don't hear any complaints about this border wall, about this fence, because you sure hear them every time an American insists one should be erected along the U.S. southern border. You certainly heard them during Israel's construction of its own security barrier, separating itself from the future Palestinian state next door. Do you notice the double standard? I mean, come on. It's as noticeable as the still open border between the U.S. and Mexico. Yes, U.S. officials are speaking out of both sides of their mouths, telling Americans it's just not practical to build barriers along its borders while using Americans' hard-earned tax dollars to build barriers along borders of foreign countries. Does this make you angry? If so, do something about it. You know, you've launched successful political movements in the past on the Savage Nation. Let's do it again, right here tonight. Give me a call at 1-800-449-8255 and start the revolution. This is Joseph Farah attempting to fill the big shoes of Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. Don't forget to check out the website, michaelsavage.com. When we get back from the break, I want to know what you think about spending your tax dollars building a border fence between Egypt and the Gaza Strip instead of building one on our southern border. 1-800-449-8255. Do we have our national priorities straight? What has happened with the border issue anyway? Why has it fallen off the radar screen? Are we being manipulated to forget about it? What are you willing to do to put it back on the front burner? Back with more of the Savage Nation after this. Savage. We're talking about what has become of what had been the number one issue of concern to the American people as we entered this presidential election year. The border, illegal immigration, national security. This was what was on people's minds, according to every national public opinion poll taken last year. And it has become totally obscured in this presidential election year, and I guess with good reason, because none of the candidates are embracing this issue. There are no new initiatives on the table to make our country secure. Why isn't anyone else pointing out this blatant duplicity here at work? We're spending millions and millions of dollars building a border fence between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. All we get is excuses, meanwhile, when it comes to our own border here at home. Let's get some callers involved here at 1-800-449-8255. Let's start with Lois in New York. Lois, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Say that America's priorities are in the wrong place for wanting to put up a border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip and not secure our own borders.
What are you going to do about it, Lois? I mean, what can we do about it? We raised this issue. Talk radio and the internet helped to galvanize this issue not that long ago. How have we let it slip off the table? And what can we do to bring it back?
Someone needs to tell our president that we need to secure our own borders. That's what they need to tell our president.
No, our president's a lame duck. You think he's listening to the Savage Nation tonight?
Well, maybe not, but we need to tell our government or someone or our new nominees if Bush won't listen to it.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Lois. Let's go to Chuck in Illinois. You're welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello. I just want to make a comment. I cannot understand how the inept Jewish government and the Jewish people, how could they let Sharon give away the Gaza Strip? Now you have this Rabbi Yeshel Eckstein, I believe his name is pronounced, on television asking for donations for the people that are getting shelled by Hamas from the Gaza Strip. It's ridiculous.
It was so predictable, wasn't it, Chuck? I mean, you know what Sharon was thinking. Sharon was thinking, I'll be happy to get rid of the Gaza Strip, just like Egypt was happy to be rid of the Gaza Strip. The problem Israel had was that this is a base of operations for terrorists who want to destroy Israel.
But they should have stayed in Gaza. They had to pull those people out of Gaza. Those Jews didn't want to go. They had enough security forces there to keep to protect Gaza. Now they give it away. Hamas is shelling them like crazy, and it's just unbelievable. I can't believe it.
Well, Sharon was a guy who helped populate Gaza with Jews, who encouraged people to go to Gaza to form a kind of a buffer zone between the Israeli border and the terrorists in Gaza. And it was working. It was working beautifully for years. I mean, there were no attacks on Israel from the Gaza Strip until Sharon withdrew. Let's go to Steve in Houston, Texas. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, hello, sir. I believe that the entire illegal immigration problem has been purposely caused by the banks. They want they wanted every single person in this country to go to college to leave a purposeful labor gap, which they could then use as a justification to bring in third world workers to do the work that the American citizens supposedly would not do, and all the kids from age 30 to 10 have been pushed every single day, college, got to go to college. Meanwhile, we're bringing in millions and millions of illegal immigrants to do the work that these people feel is now below them.
Well, I think you're onto something, Steve. You know, the bleeding hearts often talk about the plight of the illegal immigrants and, you know, how we have to welcome them here and be nice to them and so forth. But what they're forgetting is that we have victimized these people. We have uprooted them from their own homeland. We've taken 10% of the Mexican population and moved it as if by force into the United States because we've stripped the Mexican economy of jobs through NAFTA and so forth. I think you're really onto something. It may sound like a bizarre conspiracy theory to some, but how else can we explain one of the biggest population movements in modern history? Let's go to Jim in San Francisco. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
I have a question. It seems to be that everybody's forgetting here. We seem to be able to put, our government puts every vote that we want to try to get passed on the polls for our country to vote on. This is the only one that's never put out by our government. Had they put it out, I'm sure that every tax-paying American in this country would rather have their money go to a border fence than to go to be paying for medical for all these illegal immigrants and every other thing that they get that they don't pay for.
You're so right. You're so right, Jim. In fact, it's not only the government that doesn't ask the questions. It's the pollsters who don't ask the questions. It's the news media. Hey, I'm looking for ideas about how to get the most important issue facing America's security back on the front burner. This is Joseph Era sitting in for Michael Savage. Back with more after this.
Savage.
Joseph Era back for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. And don't forget about michaelsavage.com. You know, this is a website that is really unlike any other website in radio because it is a news site. Even when Michael is not here, he is updating that site all day long. It's a true reflection of his incredible news judgment. And I say that as a newsman with a deep appreciation for news judgment. We started the show tonight by talking about this plan, and I'll read it to you from Ynet News in Israel by the Associated Press. It wasn't covered by the New York Times. It wasn't covered by CNN. American officials have agreed to a $23 million aid package from which most will go toward purchasing technology to prevent being perforated and for locating underground smuggling conduits, according to information received in the Israeli political circuit. We are building an impregnable border fence. We, you, the American taxpayers, between the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula. But yet, we still don't seem to have the national will to build a border fence between the U.S. and Mexico. Maybe you thought I was going to talk about this story because it's getting a little bit of play in the national press today. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff is using his authority to bypass federal environmental and other laws to finish building 470 miles of new fence along the Mexican border this year. We keep hearing about this new fence. This is the same old fence we've been talking about for 2 years. There's nothing new here at all. We haven't built any fence yet. This is along the Arizona-Sonora border. It includes about 170 miles of a fence there. And, you know, this goes back to 2006. Remember, the Secure Fence Act called for a border-wide total of 670 miles of double fence. Well, this ain't it, folks. They're not doing that. They haven't even begun building large segments of that fence yet. The national will is still not there. And what I'm asking you is, do you have some ideas about how to make the border a center stage political issue once again amid all the distractions of the 2008 presidential race? 1-800-449-8255. You know, we did it before. How do we do it again and keep this issue in the faces of those Washington dilettantes until they get it right? Let's go to Ted in North Carolina. Ted, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi. I was thinking about the border security in terms of the war on terror. It makes no sense to me that after 9/11 that the southern border is still open. Seems to me like the war on terror is a hoax. Al-Qaeda caused NORAD to stand down.
So Al-Qaeda wasn't involved in 9/11 is what you're saying?
No, I think they were, but Osama bin Laden was a CIA operative. Obviously, he was in the beginning in the 80s.
Actually, he was never a CIA operative, for that matter. Ted, I hate to disillusion you. I know that this is an oft-repeated claim, but the CIA never supported Osama bin Laden as one of the Arab Afghans during the war against the Soviet Union. That is simply a myth. And it's a myth concocted by people who want to suggest that 9/11 was some grand conspiracy involving the U.S. government. I just can't get behind that, Ted. I'm sorry. Let's go to Andy in New York. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, hi. I wanted to mention something that's rarely mentioned on talk shows, and is the fact that our border between Mexico and the United States, for example, we have many crossing points, you know, in California, in Texas, and some of those places are highly corrupted. I mean, crossing guards, allow trucks, certain trucks at certain times, everything is prearranged. Let's say a truck, tractor trailer that went from the United States to deliver goods in Mexico sometimes comes back with 20, 30 people inside, and that truck is officially empty. So I know people that have crossed from Mexico into Texas, in McAllen, for example. Everything is picked carefully, and they go at a certain time. They go only to that specific lane where that guard is.
So what are you suggesting, that there's corruption on the part of the Border Patrol, or what? What's the takeaway here?
That's what I'm saying. There's big time corruption by the Border Patrol at some places and at some crossing points. Because,
well, you know, Andy, it wouldn't be shocking to learn that there have been incidents like that. Do you know how much money is at stake here? Do you know what Mexico's number one industry is? It's not oil. It's not tourism. It is smuggling of narcotics. And if for no other reason, let's take terrorism out of the equation. Do we really want to have a wide open border with a country whose number one industry is smuggling narcotics, selling illicit drugs? I don't think so. Let's go to Mike in, Monterey? Monterey, California. Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, that was exactly the point I was going to make, is we need to focus this on how much drugs are coming in over that border and the devastation it's applying to the youth of this country and the long-term effects that that has on people. I mean, we can stop this immediately if we just put our army on the border, stop that stuff coming across. I mean, there's more of it coming from those drugs than anything else.
Well, you're right, you know, but what I want to focus on tonight on this program is what we do once again to elevate this issue of the border to once again be the number one political issue in this country, one that Barack Obama has to address, one that Hillary Clinton has to address, one that John McCain has to address. How do we do that? I remember one of the things that led to the border issue becoming elevated. It was the Minuteman operation. And I remember Michael Savage and other talk show hosts making this an issue day after day after day so that the news media could simply not ignore it anymore. What can we do today to bring this issue more attention?
We can use their argument against them, which is they would rather have American children die than stop the drugs coming across the border. So if they want to kill American children, then leave the border open. Frame it that way.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Let's go to Barry in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make, actually, with the Minutemen. I need to do something akin to that again. You know, and I'm calling on the Californians, the Texans, and the Arizonans right now to form a group and bring this back into the national spotlight. You know, we have to have the Constitution to see this through to the end, and if we actually care about it, which I assume the people in those bordering states do, we need to do whatever it takes to keep this in the media spotlight, to keep this a political issue, and keep the fire burning so that we can actually get our military down there, we can get the fences built, and we can make a statement to the not only Mexico, but also Canada, that if anybody tries to illegally cross the border, we won't just detain you. If you don't stop, we're going to shoot and kill you.
I have a sense, Barry, that maybe the American people, for the most part, have concluded that we've dealt with this issue, that we've fixed the problem, that we've built the fence, that we have illegal immigration under control. Do you think that that is the perception out there?
Well, I can tell you personally that I thought that that was actually what had happened. I thought this was a moot point because we had discussed it. It had been in the national spotlight for so long that we're going to address it as a nation and that our political representatives were going to take the action that we required, that we demanded from them in our national opinion polls. And now I'm very shocked and dismayed as a member of the military and as a surviving member of 911 that our political system has yet again failed us, and nobody seems to be addressing the issues that we care about as a public. You know, Barack Obama, he's big on change, and I got to tell you, I want to give the guy the ball to run with it. But this is part of the change that we're talking about. As a political, as a country, we want the issues that we care about to be addressed, not the issues that they decide are going to be the hot button. And this is one of those issues. We need our nation's borders protected, period.
Thanks for the call. You know, here's what's been holding up. In this story about Chertoff's decision today, it talks about some of the things that have held up construction of the border fence until now. The Sierra Club has sued the government over a more limited waiver that Chertoff invoked last year to proceed with the fence around Arizona's San Pedro River. Apparently, they're concerned about endangered species being affected by the building of a fence. Some property owners have been trying to extort money from the federal government to give them access to their property. One of the other concerns the environmentalists have is to protect long-nosed bats and Sonoran pronghorn sheep in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge in the Barry M. Goldwater Range. I don't know, I got to believe Barry Goldwater's probably turning over in his grave if we're not building a fence because of long-nosed bats might be endangered. Let's go to Joe in Sacramento. Joe, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I enjoy I'm enjoying your program enough to call and give you my 2 cents worth. I'm not against building fences. I think that's a very good option. But before we even think about doing that, what we need to start doing is holding our politicians accountable for jobs here in America. And if every single person that hires an illegal alien is going to get fined $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, nobody's going to hire illegal aliens. And if no illegal aliens can get work, they're not going to be in California or New Mexico or Arizona or any state, they're going to be back in their country making their 2 cents a dollar flipping tortillas because they can't survive here. And if we won't have holy cities and you know, oh,
sanctuary cities,
you know, if we
nothing holy about them.
To put our foot down and say enough's enough, then the fences, I don't even think we need to build the fences. To me, it's a waste of money because they're going to run as fast as they can run.
Joe, bottom line, we got to protect our country. And protecting our country absolutely means we got to build that border fence. It is late, and the hour is late. It is past time. If we're serious about survival as a nation, we got to build that border fence. We got to take a break. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage. Back with more of the Savage Nation after this.
Savage.
Joseph Farah in for Michael Savage. And I admit it, I'm bugged tonight about the fact that the border with Mexico is still wide open. Has it escaped your notice that none of the last three major presidential candidates standing want to build our own security fence? But we'll build one for Egypt. What is going on here? I'm going to put it on you. Why are my fellow Americans standing for this outrage? Why aren't you out in the streets? Why aren't you emulating your founding fathers? Why aren't you doing something to take America back? Forget the 2008 elections. They're a lost cause as far as I'm concerned. It's time to march on Washington. And you just watch those rascals erect fences to keep you out of your own capital. They believe in fences. I'm ticked off. How about you? The border has gotten lost as a topic since the presidential campaign has whittled down to three. It's off the table as a topic. Are you going to let it fall off the table for the next 4 years? What do you think will be the consequences of continuing this laissez-faire attitude toward the southern border? Are you ready to lose the United States of America over this? Aren't those the stakes? Why have we allowed this issue to be obscured now for at least the last several months? How can we bring it back? I'll tell you one way you can bring it back, and that is by talking about it right here before millions of your fellow Americans on the Savage Nation. Nina in Chicago, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you. I think the only way to bring this all-important issue, and I think it's the most important issue facing our country right now, is for we the people to take our responsibility under the Constitution and start making some noise. And we need to start that at all levels, like in our living rooms, at the water cooler, letters to the editor, emails and phone calls to senators and representatives. And people think that that's a lost cause, but it isn't. The only reason that these people can ignore this issue is because we are not taking our responsibility and holding their feet to the fire. And until we do that, there will be nothing done.
Nina, God bless you. You are so right on. That is exactly the way we elevated this issue 2 years ago to national prominence, and it is the way to do it again. We cannot be distracted by all the noise of the 2008 presidential campaign, so much of it meaningless, as we are losing our country. Let's go to Vince in Connecticut. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thanks. You know, I do share my opinion with local radio stations on how I feel in the border fence, but I really believe that our national congressmen, representatives, whether state, local, federal, they do not care about us at all. This nation that used to be once great under the greatest generation is now turning into, you know, the greatest Mexican generation. They don't hear us. They don't want to hear us. Right here in Connecticut, to be honest with you, Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, they were once beautiful cities. Now they're like San Juan, Puerto Rico, because we're 49th in job creation. Our representatives don't hear a word we're saying. Joe Lieberman doesn't hear a word we're saying. And we're number two in welfare benefits. I shouldn't say that because they'll just come here flocking for more. Now, if we can somehow get rid of all these welfare benefits nationwide, I wish there was a real forum. I wish there was a place where we can march. I can't stand it anymore. I moved up to further up northern Litchfield County, and my taxes are, believe it or not, $5,200, which is probably cheap for Connecticut, but it's ridiculous to live here. And for what? What am I getting?
Vince, I agree with you that when you alone call or write to your local congressman, it means nothing. But when we turn up the noise collectively across this nation, as we did so successfully a couple of years ago, and it's not just you at that point, Vince, who's talking to your congressman, who's emailing him, but it's millions of other Americans. It does work. It does get their attention. These guys want one thing. They want to stay in power for as long as they possibly can. And when they get the sense that America, Americans, are concerned about an issue that they are not on top of, it's amazing what happens. Let's go to Mike in Houston, Texas. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you. My comment was that I totally disagree with you about the border fence. I'm more in line with your previous caller. I feel that the fence is too great an expense and fences are too easily breached. If you study human behavior throughout history, humans are going to naturally migrate from an area of very low opportunity to an area of very high opportunity, and we have such a difference here, it's going to be a mass migration.
Well, Mike, let me just say one thing here. If fences don't work, why are we spending tens of millions of dollars building one to separate the Gaza Strip from the Sinai Peninsula with your tax dollars? Why did the Israelis build a security fence along the West Bank? And hasn't it stopped the terrorist infiltration? Haven't the suicide bombings gone way down as a result of that fence? Fences work. This is Joseph Harris sitting in for Michael Savage. Don't forget the website, michaelsavage.com.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome to the Savage Nation, and as the good doctor says, be here or be nowhere. This is Joseph Harris sitting in for Michael Savage. You know me as the editor of WorldNet Daily. I'm honored to be filling in for my friend Michael Savage. And don't forget the website, michaelsavage.com, around the clock, 24/7, wherever you are, you can be a good citizen of the Savage Nation by going to michaelsavage.com. And, of course, you can be a part of the Savage Nation here by picking up the phone, joining the conversation at 1-800-449-8255. You know, I am sorely tempted to talk about the Bellevue, Ohio man who was arrested for having sex with the picnic table on his deck. Did you hear about this guy? I mean, if this story doesn't illustrate how badly men are in need of the civilizing influence of women, I don't know what does. I mean, I can't really talk about this on the air, can I? It is so sick, and this is a family show. We can't explore the depths of human depravity on the Savage Nation, at least not without the subtle professional nuance Dr. Savage himself brings to the microphone. So let's forget about the picnic table pervert. Get that image out of your minds. Should we talk about the British scientists who have created what they call admixed embryos by adding human DNA to cow eggs? The admixed embryos are of a kind known as cytoplasmic hybrids, or cybrids, which are made by placing the nucleus from a human cell into an animal egg that had its nucleus removed. The genetic material in the resulting embryos is 99.9% human. Do you think we ought to be doing stuff like this? Is this smart? Should this be legal? Do you think these scientists know what they are doing? Have any of them read Shelley's Frankenstein? Amazing, frightening, shocking, the times we live in. Or would you prefer to talk about the 2008 election and what it really means? When Americans think about politics, about governance, about policy matters, they tend to think about presidential elections every 4 years. I know that's why everyone is obsessed right now with Obama, McCain, Chelsea's mama. I would like to get beyond the horse race. I'd like to get beyond the distractions. I'd like to get beyond who has more money and more delegates and more superdelegates. I'd like to talk with you about what the election means to the future of this country. And I want to begin by reading you a quote from a very famous American socialist by the name of Norman Thomas. "The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt every fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without ever knowing how it happened." That's what Norman Thomas said back in the 1940s. And I've been thinking deeply about those prophetic words spoken by America's premier socialist thinker and leader. They didn't resonate in the 1940s when Franklin Roosevelt, in the name of ending the Depression, exceeded all constitutional authority by approving new federal assistance programs. They seemed probably a bit far-fetched to most of us in the 1960s when Lyndon Johnson vastly expanded the welfare state in his failed bid to end poverty in America. They still didn't connect in the 1970s. When Richard Nixon, in a bid to ingratiate himself with Democrats in Congress and to stave off an impeachment, greatly increased spending on wealth redistribution schemes and even froze wages and prices for a time. And by the 1980s, with Ronald Reagan in power, it seemed this 40-year trend had finally been reversed. But with the initiatives being proposed by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential campaign, it certainly appears Norman Thomas was right all along. Americans will indeed embrace every fragment of the socialist program in the name of liberalism. Both of the leading Democrats call for nationalized health care, for a power grab by Washington in which the federal government will seize full control of another one-seventh of the U.S. economy. This would, of course, be the most dramatic and probably irreversible step toward U.S. socialism in the nation's history. Even today, the architects of these plans conceal from the public the centralized command and control nature of the new system that they're devising. They're not asked by the press to show the American people even one successful program government has run. Yet the American people seem ready to put the lives of their children and grandchildren into the hands of Washington bureaucrats. How about Barack Obama's Global Poverty Act that would, in the next decade, transfer at least $845 billion of U.S. taxpayer money overseas? Think of Johnson's failed war on poverty going international, directed not by Americans, but by the United Nations. How we could even be debating ideas like this in the 21st century, after all of the climatic failures of socialism around the world, is simply amazing to me. But then again, we're not really debating them. It seems we're not even capable as a people of debating them, reasoning over them, using our brains to consider them. Americans may simply be too far gone spiritually, morally, and intellectually to reject the temptations of socialism. What do you think about that? That's a pretty provocative statement I just made. Americans may simply be too far gone spiritually, morally, and intellectually to reject the temptations of socialism. Is that the case? Are we too fat, lazy, stupid, and immoral to inherit and maintain the greatest experiment in liberty and self-government ever devised in the history of mankind? You tell me. 1-800-449-8255. Socialism is antithetical to human nature, yet it has great appeal to the human mind. It's one of the great lies of all time, similar to the one told by the deceiver in the Garden of Eden. You can be like God. You can have it all right here on earth. You can live in utopia, and you don't have to obey the laws of the universe to achieve it. That's the essence of socialism. And it is finally seducing America as it has seduced much of the rest of the world over the last century. That's the way I see it. That's the way I see the 2008 presidential election at this moment. How about you? 1-800-449-8255. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage. Back with more of the Savage Nation after this. Savage. And it's Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation. We're talking about socialism coming to America. Can you feel it? Do you sense it? Is it palpable to you? You know, unfortunately, Americans don't even have a political party representing clear, unequivocal opposition to socialism. The Republicans don't even dare speak its name. John McCain admits publicly he doesn't know much or care much about economics. And so Americans don't even have a reason or an electoral mechanism to say no to the socialism that is coming to our country under the guise of liberalism, just the way Norman Thomas predicted it would come. By the way, isn't that an amazing quote that I read in the first segment? This is from Norman Thomas back in the 1940s, the preeminent socialist of his time. The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt every fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without ever knowing how it happened. That's the plan. Now, maybe you don't believe me when I tell you many, if not most, of our politicians today are socialists of one stripe or another. Maybe you don't believe me when I tell you Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Ted Kennedy and John Kerry, et cetera, are socialists. Do you need proof? Because I can give you proof. Occasionally, one of these people admits what they are. And that's just what Ted Kennedy did a few years ago, right there in the congressional record. The old York Times didn't report it. The AP didn't report it. So you never heard about it. Now it's no secret that I don't like Ted Kennedy. I believe his political epitaph should have been written July 18th, 1969, the day his behavior led directly to the untimely death of Mary Jo Kopechne at the Chappaquiddick Bridge. Until that moment, as the surviving brother of an assassinated president and an assassinated senator presidential candidate, he had been an object of love and pity for an entire nation. Today, I can scarcely muster the pity. Over four decades, he has served as a kind of enemy within the American political system, attempting to elicit the support of the Soviet Union against President Reagan's policies in the 1980s, ignoring the tax-cutting prescription of his elder brother, failing to learn the real lessons of Vietnam, failing even to learn the lessons of his own brother's errors of appeasement in the Bay of Pigs, practicing his own unique brand of plantation racism, and of course, always blaming America for all the problems of the world. That's Ted Kennedy. That even one of the 50 states would deem him worthy of serving in the U.S. Senate for most of his life is something of a national disgrace. Nevertheless, maybe because of his alcohol-addled brain or his unfulfilled ego, occasionally Ted Kennedy has demonstrated a kind of candor that is in short supply in Washington. It may have been intellectual frustration that caused Kennedy to admit what he was 13 years ago, what he remains today. Ted Kennedy is and was a socialist, and he actually admitted on the floor of the Senate January 20th, 1995. I've never seen this revelation before, though it has been a matter of public record all these years, published, as it were, in the Congressional Record. Here is how the Kennedy admission came about. Are you ready for this? Economist Milton Friedman was testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in favor of a national constitutional amendment for a balanced budget. Kennedy argued that a requirement for a balanced budget would restrict the federal government's power and its ability to spend. Thus, he said, Washington's role in more fairly and equitably distributing wealth, goods, and services. Here's what Milton Friedman said to him. Senator, socialism hasn't worked in 6,000 years of recorded history. Why don't you give up on it? With that, Kennedy rose to his feet and replied, it hasn't worked in 6,000 years of recorded history because it didn't have me to run it. Now, I got to tell you, it's unlikely Barack Obama, whom Kennedy supports today for the presidency, would ever make such a candid statement. It is unlikely Hillary Clinton, who is every bit as committed to socialism as Obama, would ever make such an admission. It is unlikely John McCain, who's promoting a globalist form of socialism with his plans to take on this phantom crisis of man-made catastrophic climate change, would ever make such an admission. Yet all three are indeed promoting socialism to one extent or another. Surely Kennedy is not as sophisticated in articulating his position as the others. Surely Kennedy, with his comfortable, unchallenged position as the senior senator from Massachusetts, doesn't need to be so tactful. Surely Kennedy avoids, for the most part, heated admissions that he believes socialism can work under the right kind of skillful leadership. But in essence, most of our political leaders today have fallen victim to this idea that socialism can succeed under the right circumstances. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage, back after this.
Jalisco, Lutenes to Novia, me Guadalajara. Muchacha bonita, la perla es más raja, en todo Jalisco es me Guadalajara.
There he is.
Jalisco no te rajes, me sala del amor. Cantor, cantor,
thank you, Ted. Thank you, Ted. We get the idea. We're talking about socialism coming to America, and that's the way it's going to come. Have you ever heard this quote from Kennedy before that I read to you in the last segment? This is incredible. This is amazing. Milton Friedman is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee in favor of a constitutional amendment for a balanced budget. And Kennedy's arguing with him, telling him, well, this is going to prevent us from, you know, giving money to the poor, et cetera, et cetera. Milton Friedman says, and I quote, "Senator, socialism hasn't worked in 6,000 years of recorded history. Why won't you give up on it?" To which Kennedy replies, "It hasn't worked in 6,000 years of recorded history because it didn't have me to run it." Amazing. I wish all liberals would be this candid. Most of our political leaders, as I mentioned in the last segment, have fallen victim to this idea that socialism can succeed under the right circumstances. Most of our media leaders believe it. Most of our cultural leaders believe it. And sad to say, too many ordinary Americans have fallen prey to this seductive but evil ideology. And that, to me, is what is at stake in the 2008 election. Well, we can choose the fast road to socialism and tyranny, or we can take a detour that leads essentially to the same destination. I'm sorry to say, those are our choices. Are you ready for socialism to come to America? Let's go to Charles in New York. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Joseph, I want to give you an example and prove to you that it's already too late. All of the candidates, the media, and the American public has completely bought into socialism right now. If you remember a couple months ago during one of the debates, a hypothetical situation was posed to all of the candidates, which basically consisted of Al-Qaeda has planted a nuclear bomb in an American city, and it's going to go off. Now, you can prevent this by interrogating and torturing an Al-Qaeda operative in our possession, and you can stop the slaughter of millions of people. And all of the and each candidate responded that they would not torture that Al-Qaeda operative, but they would allow millions of people to perish.
Even the Republicans? This is when there were still multiple Republicans in the race?
They were. That was one of the very first debates where there was eight candidates on the dais.
Unbelievable. Well, it doesn't surprise me that John McCain would have that attitude, because he is the leader of this idea that we have to stop coercive interrogations. He doesn't call them that. He calls it torture. It's not torture. Coercive interrogations, my goodness, are absolutely a vital necessity of any military strategy during wartime. It has been with us throughout American history, through the history of all of the nations of the world. There are times when you have no choice but to use coercive methods to get information out of people. I can't believe that, because I think if you ask that question, correct me if I'm wrong, Charles, if you ask that question to 10 Americans, ordinary Americans, 9 of them would tell you, absolutely, go for it.
It's true. I have. You're right. But nobody had a problem that night, the interviewer, the audience, and none of the candidates. That was the correct answer.
Amazing. Well, that I'm not even sure that has anything to do with socialism. I just think that has to do with common sense, with good judgment.
Have the authority to slaughter millions of people and everybody go along with it. What else is that? Fascism?
Thanks for the call, Charles. I don't remember that debate. I must have missed that one, but I will take your word for it. Let's go to Jamie in Tampa, Florida.
Hey, Joe. Just want to say thank you very much. I listen to talk radio a lot, and to be honest with you, this is the first time I've ever heard so much truth in such a small part of time.
Well, thank you. That's very nice. That's a very nice compliment.
Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate WorldNet Daily, too, and Jerome Corsi and all the things. I think people need to look at that and start reading some of Jerome Corsi to understand what's happening to our country.
Well, what's the answer, Jamie? I mean, the one thing I don't want to do is I don't want to leave everybody, you know, on a bummer, on a negative, that there's nothing that can be done. Like the last caller said, it's too late. Yeah, it might be too late, but, you know, history is cyclical. And I think we need to be focusing on what we need to do to bring back common sense to the American people, to bring back some discernment and good judgment. What can we do?
Well, I don't know why the media ignored Ron Paul so much, if it was, what the problem was with him. But he was the most conservative. You know, the only difference he had was he didn't want to go over to Iraq and, you know, but everybody ties the Republican Party to this war, and that's BS right there.
Yeah, well, you know, that was part of my problem with Ron Paul. It wasn't so much that he didn't want to go to Iraq. Not wanting to go to Iraq could have been a good decision in retrospect. But what bothered me about Ron Paul was the idea that he would precipitously bring the troops home, which would do one thing. It would signal absolute white flag surrender to Islamo-fascism. This would have been a celebratory day for bin Laden. And I couldn't countenance that.
That's where we differ, I guess. I think that whole thing is a fabrication. I mean, we started Al-Qaeda, the United States government.
Well, we dealt with that before. No, we didn't start Al-Qaeda. No, that's a myth. And I don't know whether Ron Paul is part of that myth, but we never supported Osama bin Laden. We never supported Al-Qaeda. I know what people are talking about. We supported the Arab Afghans in their war to defend their country from the Soviet invasion. We did not support bin Laden's faction. Thanks very much for the call, Jamie. Let's go to Kathy in San Diego. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Joseph. Joseph, one of the points that you did leave out on the talking about socialism and our politicians, yes, our politicians, I fully agree with everything you're saying, do want to take us in a very socialistic direction, but they do not want to participate and be part of it. They are really have the wealth and the power to be able to separate themselves so they will not be part of the socialistic bent.
Oh, you're so right. Well, you know, socialist leaders never do that. They want to be among, there's always a privileged class in socialist countries, and they're ready to embrace being a part of that privileged class. It was true in the Soviet Union. It's true in China today. It was true for Fidel Castro for all those years. It's true for, you know, Kim Il-jung in North Korea. You think he's suffering along with his people? Is he starving? Of course not. Take one look at him.
No, I agree completely. One other point I'd like to make, Joseph, and that is the people that are going along with this. I think you have a lot of factions of society, a lot of people that, of course, are already on programs that they are getting help from the government, possibly people that are working for the government. But in my own case, I have a granddaughter that's turning 18 this year, and she will be voting for the first time. She's never held a job. She just does not really understand the dynamics. And unfortunately, she and her generation are the ones that are going to be paying the cost of what will happen if the right people, and at this point, you've already said it, we don't have the right person running for president, but the least offensive of the ones that we do have running.
Thank you, Kathy. Good call. Let's go to Linda in Michigan. Linda, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, please keep pounding this message through to the American people. I'm seeing it seep in on our television shows like Oprah's Big Give and Extreme Home Makeover. You know, I couldn't put a name to it, but it was bothering me that this is so common now. Give, give, give. Take, take, take.
Oh, you know, it's true. I mean, look, you know, I just did my taxes, you know, and I found out I'm getting a $1,500 economic stimulus rebate. And now I'm taking it because, you know, frankly, I don't think they should have taken nearly as much as they did from my paychecks last year. But nevertheless, I mean, what is that all about? It's about buying votes. Pure and simple.
And I don't want Grandma Clinton taking care of me or Obama, any of them. I guess John Wayne McCain either. I don't know. I don't know what to do.
Well, thank you, Linda. Stay tuned, and maybe we can give you some ideas about what you can do. Let's go to Bobby in Las Vegas. You're on the Savage Nation.
I wanted to just respond to Charles a few callers back and tell him that maybe that one prospective informer, we might have wanted to turn him over to the Israelis or maybe any other prospective informers and let them deal with it, and we could be off the hook, and maybe they'd come up with some information. They seem to have some good tactics.
Appreciate the call, Bobby, but I got to tell you, you know, the Israelis, as Michael Savage has said on his program many times, the Israelis just aren't the Israelis anymore. I mean, they're infected with this same socialist mindset over there, this same idea of, you know, if we're only nice to our enemies, then they're going to be nice back to us. It just doesn't work in the real world. You know, if your political involvement in 2008 is limited to pulling a lever for one presidential candidate or another, and, you know, that's the choice we have before us. But I don't think we're limited to that kind of political involvement. In fact, I think we each make more important political choices every single day of the year than we do when we cast a presidential vote. We make political choices when we decide how our children will be educated. We make political choices when we decide where we surf on the internet. We make political choices when we decide which talk show we listen to. We make political choices when we choose a church, when we support charities, when we shop, when we go to the movies, when we watch TV. All these decisions affect the future of our country in some small way. Many of them in much bigger ways than our vote for president. And that's the way I think we need to start thinking about taking our country back. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage, back with more of the Savage Nation after this. Savage.
I've got two daughters, 9 years old and 6 years old. I'm going to teach them, first of all, about values and morals. But if they make a mistake, I don't want them punished with a baby. I don't want them punished with an STD at the age of 16. You know, so it doesn't make sense to not give them information. You still want to teach them the morals and the values to make good decisions.
Unbelievable. Well, there's our next president. He believes that babies are a form of punishment. Just absolute. Hey, by the way, did you know that Barack Obama went to the Million Man March, the one that was organized by Louis Farrakhan? Now, I have to believe both of them, you know, being Chicago natives, have probably more in common than just the fact that Barack Obama went to the Million Man March. I ran across this story, profile of Barack Obama going back to 1995 when he was just running for the state Senate in Illinois at that time. This is a story in the Chicago Reader, one of those alternative newspapers. And I'd like to read you a few quotes by Barack Obama back in 1995. I can't believe that this piece hasn't been accessed and highlighted by others. Obama says, in America, we have this strong bias toward individual action. You know, we idolize the John Wayne hero who comes in to correct things with both guns blazing. But individual actions, individual dreams are not sufficient. We must unite in collective action, build collective institutions and organizations. Does that bring it home for you? These are code words that have been used by socialists for, you know, 75 years. Here's another one. The right wing talks about this, but they keep appealing to that old individualistic bootstrap myth. Get a job, get rich, and get out. Instead of investing in our neighborhoods, that's what has always happened. Our goal must be to help people get a sense of building something larger. Here's another quote from Barack Obama, 1995. The right wing, the Christian right, has done a good job of building these organizations of accountability much better than the left or progressive forces have. But it's always easier to organize around intolerance, narrow-mindedness, and false nostalgia. And they also have hijacked the higher moral ground with this language of family values and moral responsibility. Now, we don't want any of that. Moral responsibility, my goodness, family values. These guys cringe from this terminology. Here's another quote from Barack Obama circa 1995, talking about the Million Man March in Washington, D.C., from which he had just returned. What I saw was a powerful demonstration of an impulse and need for African-American men to come together to recognize each other and affirm our rightful place in the society. There was a profound sense that African-American men were ready to make a commitment to bring about change in our communities and lives. Any solution to our unemployment catastrophe must arise from us working creatively within a multicultural, interdependent, and international economy. Boy, that word interdependent. When I hear that, and this is the way I want you to hear it from now on, whenever you hear that word interdependent, understand that it is the opposite of independent. Independence, something that our nation was founded upon. These guys want to build a global village. They don't care about our founding fathers and the vision that made this country great, that made it a shining city on a hill. They want to make us interdependent, which actually means dependent, doesn't it? It's just a euphemism for dependent. He continues, any African Americans who are only talking about racism as a barrier to our success are seriously misled if they don't also come to grips with the larger economic forces that are creating economic insecurity for all workers, whites, Latinos, and Asians. We must deal with the forces that are depressing wages, lopping off people's benefits right and left, and creating an earnings gap between CEOs and the lowest paid worker that has risen in the last 20 years from a ratio of 10 to 1 to one of better than 100 to 1. This doesn't suggest that the need to look inward emphasized by the march isn't important and that these African-American tribal affinities aren't legitimate. These are mean, cruel times, exemplified by a lock-em-up, take-no-prisoners mentality that dominates the Republican-led Congress. Keep in mind, as he's speaking these words, who's presiding over the United States of America, over the federal government? It's Bill Clinton! Historically, he says, African Americans have turned inward and towards black nationalism whenever they have a sense, as we do now, that the mainstream has rebuffed us. That's Barack Obama. We're talking about how socialism is coming to America. This is Joseph Ferris sitting in for Michael Savage. Back with more of the Savage Nation after this, and don't forget the website, michaelsavage.com.
Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Degrees hotter in 10, not 10, but in 30 or 40 years, and basically none of the crops will grow. Most of the people will have died, and the rest of us will be cannibals. Civilization will have broken down. What the few people who are left will be living in a failed state like Somalia or Sudan, and living conditions will be intolerable. The droughts will be so bad there'll be no more corn growing.
Welcome to the Savage Nation. Joseph Farah of WorldNet Daily sitting in for the one and only doctor of discernment, Michael Savage. What you just heard, ladies and gentlemen, is proof positive that you don't have to be smart to be rich and powerful. That was Ted Turner on the Charlie Rose show last night on PBS. The founder of CNN, Ted Turner, was talking about the fact that we have to respond immediately to this global warming catastrophe that is on the horizon. That if we don't act right now, that in a few years, he's not sure whether it's 10, 30, or 40, but one of those, it will be 8 degrees hotter, 8 degrees in 10, 30, or 40 years, and most of the people will have died, and the rest of us will be cannibals. That's what he said. Let's hear the clip again. It is unbelievable.
We'll be 8 degrees hotter in 10, not 10, but in 30 or 40 years, and basically none of the crops will grow. Most of the people will have died, and the rest of us will be cannibals. Civilization will have broken down. What the few people who are left will be living in a failed state like Somalia or Sudan, and living conditions will be intolerable. The droughts will be so bad there'll be no more corn growing.
I mean, this doesn't even, merit a response. It really doesn't. It's that inane. But nevertheless, let's just, for the sake of amusement, let's enter the realm of conjecture. Let's say that these people who believe in imminent, the man-made catastrophe of climate change is on the horizon. It's imminent. And it's all because mankind is producing too much carbon dioxide. Let's say that is the case, just for the sake of argument. Now, what could we possibly do in the next 30 to 40 years to prevent this temperature from rising 8 degrees globally? What would he have us do? Would he have us suspend all industry? When in fact, any scientist will tell you that the man-made carbon dioxide represents only an infinitesimally small percentage of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So if we stop doing everything, if we stop breathing today, would it have any effect on the global temperature over the next 30 or 40 years? You tell me. Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage, 1-800-449-8255. This is absolutely amazing. Ted Turner, this is the guy who started CNN, one of the most powerful people, wealthiest people. This is the single biggest land owner in North America, Ted Turner. And this is what he says. 30, 40 years, most of us will be dead. The rest of us will be cannibals. Amazing stuff. Let's go to the phones. 1-800-449-8255. Eric in York, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello. Global warming's a bunch of hooey. But if Ted Turner really wants to make a point, if it gets 8 degrees warmer, think of all the billions of acres of land that could grow crops in frozen northern Canada, Siberia. Most of the land is up in northern hemisphere, in northern latitudes.
Maybe that's why he bought 3/4 of Montana.
Gonna grow bananas.
Well, he's growing bison, and he's butchering them. He's got a restaurant where he serves nothing but bison, and so he's making the best of a bad situation.
It's just so much land to grow crops, it just grows caribou.
Appreciate the call, Eric. Let's go to Steve in Virginia. What's on your mind tonight? Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Joseph. I definitely think Congress has gone too far morally. Look at the DREAM Act, S-2205, but I think a solution for the Savage Nation and the entire nation vote on any bill currently pending in Congress, and then they send the results to the entire Congress. So while it doesn't, it's not a complete solution, it's a sure good step in the right direction for America trying to take back control over this country from the liberals and the socialists.
Good point. Now all we have to do is make sure America's thinking straight. I mean, if we want to get to a more democratic kind of a situation, what is your perception of the state of the American mind today, Steve? Are we capable of self-government in 2008?
Well, I think clearly folks on both coasts tend to be more social. They've gone farther down that road. But I think if the conservatives of America start using this website and the traditional resources that talk radio has mobilized, then we can start our own movement, and these other folks will eventually pay attention and start getting on board and using this website, because they're talking about having a voting scorecard. So basically the day before the election, you could compare your personal votes to all of your congressmen, your senators, your rep, and even the president were applicable, as well as the presidential candidates. And I mean, that's powerful information to use on the day before the election to see how these politicians walk the talk, or did they go in a completely different direction?
Yeah, well, it can hurt. I mean, I think that there are tools out there that can be assets to any good political movement. But, you know, my problem is that I think that the culture, the American culture, is so degraded at this point that I sometimes have moments when I wonder whether we are worthy of inheriting this country, the one that our founders fought so hard for, fought for independence, fought for sovereignty, fought for personal liberty. Are we worthy, and are we capable of governing ourselves in the way that they envisioned us doing 232 years ago? Appreciate the call. Let's go to Phil in Orlando. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you. Good evening. You know, there's one solution. You know, I keep hearing people say the socialists are taking over and all this, and it's true. But the one solution that I have in mind is if people got out and got off their cans on election day and went to vote. We have between 55% and 65% of our electorate turnout for elections. If the majority of the American people truly believe in the founding fathers and the principles we were founded on, they would understand that the only way they're going to turn this tide is to go vote these people out of office, vote for people who stand up for American principles and for the traditions of this country. I don't see it happening. I talk to a lot of people at work and personal friends and so forth. They don't want to talk about politics. They don't want to hear about it. And to more to the point of your second question about whether we're worthy, I kind of have that same question myself.
Do you want those people voting, Phil? I mean, if they're not thinking about politics and they don't want to talk about politics and they don't know what's going on and they don't know which end is up, do you really want those people voting?
I want them to be educated, and I want them to vote. I hear too many people call these programs and call talk radio and talk about how they're concerned that this is happening and that's happening. We're losing this freedom and that freedom. If all of those people who read the papers and decry all of this stuff would actually get up and go vote, yes, I think we could make a difference.
All right. I appreciate the call. When we get back from the next break, I want to talk about something else that we haven't talked about much lately. I mean, we being the people, radio talk show hosts, anybody talking about the growing threat of nuclear terrorism. We've heard about it ever since September 11th, and there's a new Senate investigation underway into the seriousness of this threat. We'll talk about that when the Savage Nation returns. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage. And don't forget about the website, michaelsavage.com. Back after this.
Savage.
Joseph Farah back, sitting in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation, and hearings began today in the United States Senate. This out of USA Today today, as they say. The government must act to reduce the threat of nuclear terrorism in a major U.S. city. Senior government officials and top terrorism experts are scheduled to tell the Senate in those hearings that began today, testifying as part of a months-long Senate investigation into the government's ability to prevent a nuclear attack. The experts will paint a chilling picture of a post-nuclear America, hundreds of thousands of dead, $1 trillion in damage and panic nationwide. That's if one small nuclear detonation takes place. The prospect of terrorists detonating a nuclear device on American soil sometime within the next quarter century is real and growing, according to prepared testimony from Gary Anthony Ackerman, research director of the Homeland Security Department-funded National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. Such a calamitous attack would represent a game-changing event far exceeding the impact of 9/11 on the nation. You know, We often talk about, Michael talks about on this program, the fact that, you know, our federal government is supposed to be limited under the Constitution. There are just certain things the government is authorized, empowered to do, and there are other things that it's not empowered to do. For instance, you can read the Constitution from beginning to end. There's not a hint in there about providing health care to every man, woman, and child in the country. It's not there. It's just simply not within the authority of the federal government to be involved. Education is something the federal government is not supposed to be involved in, not empowered to be involved in. This, however, protecting the American people from attack, that is the number one thing that the federal government is charged with doing. And it's doing darn little, in my opinion. What can be done? Of course, you know, I'm sure these hearings will focus on securing nuclear materials worldwide, that sort of thing, stopping nuclear proliferation, all good ideas. Nobody wants to see Iran become a nuclear power, which it probably is already. On the other hand, there are lots of things the federal government could be doing to prepare the American people for this kind of catastrophe, a catastrophe that will make global warming look like, you know, a day in the park. And none of those things the American government is doing. Homeland Security is not doing. Those old enough to remember the 1960s will remember that we had a civil defense structure in this country. It's gone, completely gone. In the 1970s, it was dismantled purposely by federal bureaucrats who didn't want us to be able to envision the idea of surviving a nuclear attack. They told us over and over, oh, you can't survive, you just can't survive. And so they dismantled the kinds of protections that would make survivability a likelihood. And, you know, I'd sure like to see the – what about you? Would you like to see us get back to some kind of a civil defense program, especially one that educates people about things that they can do, the responsibilities they have individually, families, communities, to have a certain amount of food and water on hand, those basic necessities? I mean, today – it's like, you know, the grocery store's closed. What am I going to do? I'm going to starve to death. You know, we've got to prepare America for this. I don't know if it's going to happen, but it could. It's much more likely to happen than global warming is going to flood the East Coast. You know, 1-800-449-8255 is the number on the Savage Nation here. Let's go to Bob in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to the Savage Nation, sir.
Well, I think one thing to put this in perspective is just look at what happened in the aftermath of Katrina. What was preparedness there? There were so many people that were relying upon the government to come and help them. It was a disaster in and of itself, just in that alone. I mean, and
there was a warning there. There were days worth of warnings in Katrina. We're not going to have those warnings if a nuclear bomb goes off in this country. So this is the time to prepare. It's everybody's responsibility to prepare, but it's also the responsibility, I believe, of the federal government to educate people, to give them ideas about things to do, practical steps they can take. Am I right?
Absolutely. I grew up in the 60s under the threat of an attack from the Soviet Union, where there was preparedness. I mean, in the schools, we had civil defense drills where you go to the basement, or, you know, my dad had a fallout shelter where it was fully stocked. And, you know, and it's like all of a sudden now it's, it doesn't feel good to think about that. It doesn't make us feel good.
How about you, Bob? Are you prepared? Your family prepared for a potential disaster of some kind?
Well, I have all my call my battle box. I mean, it's, you know, I have some staples set aside and, you know, a certain level of preparedness, but I don't think I'm fully prepared.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, that's good. You're probably five steps ahead of the average person in this country. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Eric in Virginia. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Oh, we don't have time for you, Eric. Hang on the line. We'll get back to you. We'll get back to you after this break. It wasn't watching the clock. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage. Back with more of the Savage Nation after this.
Savage.
Joseph Ferry in for Michael Savage, and of course you can tell I'm a rank amateur going to a caller just as a break is approaching. We were talking to Eric in Virginia. Eric, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Well, thank you. I'm still here. I agree with what you said about the federal government supposedly supposed to be limited in power, but looking at it from the other side of the fence, I mean, things like Katrina and No Child Left Behind, that certainly proves how limited our government is in power. being sarcastic, but again, looking from the other side of the fence, I mean, in terms of education, I think that if we put too much trust in the government to educate us, I don't think we as a people will be educated in the sense that we can really be well informed. I don't think we can trust the government to educate us in that regard. We have to educate ourselves about the issues that face us for sustainability and everything across the board. We have to educate ourselves on how government functions and to take an active role in that, to if the government is by the people and for the people, we've been asleep at the helm when we don't demand transparency and we don't hold government officials accountable for the charge that we put in their hands to, you know, to lead this nation.
I think you're absolutely dead on accurate, Eric. I appreciate the call. And as far as education goes, of course, you know, I mentioned that the Constitution doesn't mention education. The furthest thing from the founders' minds was that the federal government would ever entangle itself, become involved in education. These were people who were self-educated, home-educated for the most part. You know, they went to great universities. You know, I think Adams, I think, was a youngster, teenager, when he entered Harvard University, which was a Christian university at that time. So, you know, I'm dead set against public education across the board, but certainly the federal government has no business being involved in it at all. You know, we're talking about the threat of nuclear terrorism earlier, and USA Today having a big story about the Senate hearings that are getting underway. And it raises a question in my mind, which something I've pondered, thought about, and that is, what did we do? Okay, you know, it's going to be a big disaster if a nuclear terrorist attack ever does strike this country. And there'll be, you know, lots of dead people, injured people that we'll have to take care of. But after that, and what is our response to that? That's really the question. What should we do if and when that attack takes place? We've seen the scenario on shows like 24, for instance. What America's nuclear arsenal maintained an uneasy peace for 50 years during the Cold War, when we had thousands of nuclear weapons targeting the United States from the Soviet Union. The leaders of the nuclear armed Soviet Union knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that a nuclear attack on the U.S. And remember, it was probably the only hope the Soviet Union had for ever defeating the U.S. would lead to an all-out nuclear counterattack and the virtual destruction of its workers' paradise. That policy was called MAD, for Mutually Assured Destruction. But you know what? There wasn't anything crazy about MAD. Until Ronald Reagan came along with his idea for an anti-missile strategic defense, this kind of nuclear deterrence was the only thing that saved the U.S. from a certain attack by the Soviet Union. Well, the Cold War may be over. Sometimes I have my doubts. But the nuclear threat to the U.S. is not. You've got Russia, despite many arms control agreements, designed to make us safe. They still have a nuclear arsenal large enough to destroy the U.S. many times over. You got China, another growing nuclear power with the capability of destroying some major U.S. cities. You got North Korea and other rogue nations rapidly developing the capacity to target the U.S. with nuclear armed missiles. But all those nation state threats are mitigated somewhat by the concept of MAD, as well as the very primitive stage of a missile defense program begun under Ronald Reagan. The real potent threat comes from enemies who would never consider firing a nuclear warhead on an intercontinental ballistic missile. The threat, some experts and high-ranking government officials say, is a virtual inevitability, comes from nuclear-armed terrorists who covertly detonate one or more bombs after sneaking them into the U.S., probably across the unguarded Mexican border. Now, how do we reduce the likelihood of a catastrophe of that magnitude? Some suggest we can leave it up to the Department of Homeland Security, a bloated bureaucracy responsible for welcoming into this country millions of unidentified, undetected illegal aliens, any one of whom could be involved in what Al-Qaeda has called its American Hiroshima plot. Others suggest the answer is to fight nuclear proliferation, and we'll hear a lot about that in these Senate hearings that are taking place now. Yet that idea is the equivalent of putting a nuclear genie back in a bottle. Dr. A.Q. Khan of Pakistan probably put the final nail in the coffin of that policy prescription when he proliferated nuclear weapons all over the Islamic world. It's interesting that in the presidential race that began last year, only Representative Tom Tancredo of the presidential candidates put forth the proposition that it was time to make deterrence work for us again, like it did with the Soviet Union. Tancredo said we need to find that deterrent soon or face the inevitability of a nuclear 9/11. And I agree. Well, what does that mean? How do we do that? The nuclear terrorist threat today largely comes from radical jihadists, though they're sometimes seemingly stateless players who don't seem to put much value on their own lives. I have never believed these maniacs are invulnerable to real-world threats or immune to the consequences of them. There are so-called holy places and population centers they don't want to see destroyed. There are nations and cities they don't want to see vaporized. There are strategic sites they don't want to see turned to glass. And I was right there behind Tom Tancredo in urging a national dialogue to discuss, to identify those targets. It is not pleasant business. But neither will be a nuclear attack on the U.S. We are talking about preventing an unthinkable nightmare scenario that is, as Tancredo and George Bush and Dick Cheney and many others have suggested, all but assured without a specific deterrence prescription. It is, in my opinion, important for our enemies to know what the cost will be for an attack on the U.S. It shouldn't be a secret any more than it was a secret to the Soviet Union. Osama bin Laden, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and the other Hitlers in headscarves, as Michael Savage has called them, who have sworn to bring the U.S. to its knees, need to be told in no uncertain terms what the consequences of a nuclear or radiological attack on America will mean to them, their people, and their so-called holy sites. What do you think about that? Is that something we should be talking about? Should we be having a national debate about what our response will be to a nuclear terrorist attack? Let's go to Jason in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, sir. I'd like to discuss the port security topic you brought up earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of research in this field of nuclear physics and such, and there's two gentlemen, Thomas Cochran and Matthew McKenzie, who are both the leading experts in this field, who have studied this to great length, and they found amazing large gaping holes in the security at our ports, specifically in regard to what they call TEUs, which are basically they're the large containers that you see to come off the ships and get loaded onto the back of semis, and the semis
right.
drive them out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these containers are scanned by radiological detectors.
Well, maybe 4% of them are.
If we're lucky.
Right.
They're trying. So far, we've spent over $1 billion of our money, taxpayer money, in funding these programs. For example, like the Advanced Spectroscopic Portal, and these machines have been found to basically they set off tons of false alarms from everything from kitty litter, concrete, the things that have a radiological signature.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, the Port Authority then, of course, will use handheld detectors and such and search through a little container and such. But they found that our detectors cannot detect HEU, highly enriched uranium, which is the threat. And they've done countless blind studies where they've sent people through with DU, or depleted uranium, which gives off the almost exact same radiological decay signature as in highly enriched uranium. And so they'll send, but it's harmless. Like it's, you know, you could, if you put it in a bomb, it's not going to do anything. It's not going to create a nuclear reaction like HEU does. And they run these containers with this amount of radiological material, and put them in basic, I mean, the same route a terrorist would take from, like, from Pakistan to Turkey, from Turkey to on a ship, from the ship to Mexico, from the Mexico or to, you know, any number of the ports at, like, Atlanta or New York or L.A. And every time they've done these tests, it's gotten through.
Well, ABC News did one of those tests using depleted uranium, brought it in from Turkey into New York Harbor, and it went undetected. That was a rather famous incident several years ago. So nothing has improved since then, is what you're telling me.
Absolutely nothing. And this is one of the things that Congress is meeting on, is to discuss, do we keep funneling billions of dollars in this money pit when it's not working? And we're creating all these false positives, which is wasting. I mean, I'm talking over 100 of these false positives a day. The amount of containers that come into this country, I don't know that people understand. It's around 297 million containers a year.
Right. Jason, what do you think about the idea of establishing a nuclear deterrence policy as a matter of national policy? If the U.S. is hit in a nuclear terrorist attack, there will be a nuclear response. We don't even have to be specific about what it is, although I think you can argue both sides of that. But assuring our enemies that there will be an in-kind nuclear response. Good idea, bad idea?
I think it's a good idea. I think a better idea is another step, which is eliminating HEU from the environment. There is not a lot of highly enriched uranium out there because it's created in reactors. A few of the countries that we know that have these abilities are like Russia, Pakistan, the United States. And these reactors, when the uranium is enriched, gives off certain signatures that are distinct to that region. And we can detect and trace the uranium, and that's one of the ways that we would determine how or where the bomb came from. But eliminating is like, for example, creating an international law, perhaps, that limits this highly enriched uranium.
Jason, I hate to interrupt you. It's a good informative call, but I'm late for a break. I really got to run. This is Joseph Farah sitting in for Michael Savage. Back with more of the Savage Nation after this. Savage. Vera back. It's been a lot of fun sitting in for Michael Savage on the Savage Nation, and fun and a great honor, I might add. Let's, in the remaining moments, let's blow through some calls here. Let's start with Adam in New Jersey. What's on your mind, Adam?
Hello. How do you do? You know, I think the problem about nuclear proliferation and a nuclear bomb blowing up in America is just madness on our part. We have too many Americans who've become September 10th people. In Manhattan, where I work, my God, I don't know, is it full of people who are too intelligent for their own good or too ignorant for their own good? But to all these people, somehow Bush is the root of evil. The real bad guys who'd love to murder them with a nuke, they're just whatever. And when I remind people, hey, you know, on September 11th, those 19 maniacs who killed 3,000 of us, if they had a nuke, they would gladly use it.
Oh, you bet they would, Adam. Appreciate the call. Appreciate the sentiment. Let's go to Roy in New York. Roy, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, my call is not about nuclear threat. It's more about the threat of alarmism about climate change. I'm a science educator, and I've been dealing with this for at least the past year, ever since Al Gore's movie, and trying to get some sense and some facts and some science into the issue.
Where do you teach, Roy?
I teach here in Long Island, actually.
In a public school?
I'm a high school educator. And for the audience, your caller, two callers ago, was talking about we need to really become educated and take responsibility for our knowledge on these subjects, because the media is really not helping out. I don't even know if they're competent enough to actually explain the issue. But
Roy, let me ask you a question. Were you mandated to show Al Gore's movie in your classroom?
Heavens no, but many people are showing it because they with good intentions, because they think they're doing something good and they believe it, but they don't really have the competence to detect some of the the flaws in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think is, especially for your audience, I mean, I'm sure there's millions of people listening, but I can throw you out a couple of scientists that they can go Google. Bob Carter down in Australia does a wonderful presentation. If they just go to YouTube, click in Bob Carter, they can see a great presentation. He's a paleoclimatologist, and he can give you a perspective to the historical climate that really gives people an idea that we really shouldn't be so much alarmed because you know, Greenland's been 5 degrees Celsius warmer than it is today. And, you know, we still have the polar bears. Mm-hmm. During the Holocene period, which is within the last 10,000 years, we have a period of 1,000 years that is warmer than it is today, and the polar bears are still with us, you know. So people need to get some perspective. They don't realize the alarmism is really generated from these computer models that are trying to predict the future. And the future is science fiction. It's not science.
You're absolutely right, Roy. You are so dead on. I wish we could talk to you for longer, but we appreciate the heads up. Let's go to Ted in Louisiana. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
You're doing a fine job for Mike Savage. I listen to him all the time. So you're a rookie, but you're doing okay.
Thank you, Ted.
Quick comment on this nuclear thing here. I just think that we're already late. And I don't think there's anything that we can do because I think that the stage is set. The curtain will go up. The scene will be a devastated America. I just think that the federal government has let us down. And, you know, because the bomb hasn't gone off now, people are still depending on the federal government. Well, me personally, I'm sort of limited in my income, but I've been collecting water and food. People can call me.
Good for you, Ted. That is a very, very important thing for every American to do. That's where civil defense starts, you know, not being dependent on somebody taking care of you in an emergency situation.
That's right, and we're going to have to do it together as Americans and leave this black and white issue out, Democrat, Republican, because all of that doesn't make any sense now. And once the final comment, so I don't take up too much time, I would just like to say it's not a question of if they will. If you look at history, every weapon that man has made, we have used it in one way or the other. And I think, unfortunately, not being a pessimist, I think that this is what we're actually dealing with. And if they do, or when they do, detonate those nukes in America, I mean, who are we really going to strike at? I mean,
thank you, Ted. Thank you, Ted. Very prescient call to end the program on. It has been a pleasure. Joseph Arab and sitting in for Michael Savage. And remember, when we're not here, where are we? MichaelSavage.com.
Savage.